Thank you. Now we can hear the case of Sidman versus Sidman. Sidman, it's not versus, I don't think. Yes, it is, I guess. Ready, counsel, you may begin.
May it please the court. Leo Finkelstein, number 18455.
Say that again.
Leo Finkelstein.
Thank you.
Number 18455, Colorado Springs, appearing on behalf of the appellants, Mike and Renee Sidman, who are the legal guardians of the child in this case, D.I.S. They're also his aunt and uncle. We've been before this court twice before. I remember both, I believe, Judge Carparelli did the first opinion and Justice Rivera did the second opinion. This current case simply arose because while the second appeal was pending, and that was the issue as to whether you could use guardian's income in calculation of a parent's duty of support. While that was pending, the parents sought an order from the district court to allocate medical expenses for the child, 61% to the guardians and 39% to the parents, the extraordinary medical expenses pursuant to child support statutes. And Judge Sells, who is the fourth judicial officer to have had this case down in the district court, simply ruled that based upon the law of the case doctrine, he was following Judge Kennedy's opinion, which said you use the guardian's income in the child support statutes, and therefore it remains that extraordinary expenses are distributed 39% to parents and 61% to guardians. That decision was reversed by this court. Justice Rivera, you were sitting that day and you wrote the opinion. Your decision was cert was applied to the Supreme Court and they denied cert on July 19, so approximately 2 weeks ago. I called the clerk of court in this case this morning and they told me that the mandate was issuing either today or tomorrow. So the mandate will be issuing on that opinion. It is our position that when you reversed that decision, it effectively reverses Judge Sells' decision that relied on Judge Kennedy's first decision. And specifically, in reversing the first child support decision, what this court held was that guardian's income is not used in the calculation of child support. And a second issue in that case was, therefore, the guardians don't pay a proportion of travel expenses because the statute says travel expenses are divided by the parents in proportion to income. You flip up one subsection from subsection 11 to subsection 10 in the child support statute, and extraordinary medical expenses are identical. They're paid by the parents in proportion to income. It's our belief that the second decision of this court, for which the mandate is now issuing, governs and controls. And indeed, in their answer brief, the parents concede that that decision is controlled. What they did was they argued that it was wrongly decided. Now, when they did that, of course, they had a petition for certiorari pending. So they're preserving an issue, but that petition
well, Mr. Finkelstein, let me interrupt you for a moment. the parents in this case have any further recourse in addition to the cert petition which they filed with the Colorado Supreme Court, which was denied on July 19th. What about going to the United States Supreme Court?
That would be a potential. So far, nothing has been filed.
All right, thank you. But they have 90 days, though, don't they, or something like that?
They do, but I don't think that the your issuance of the mandate is dependent upon that. So the arguments that they're making to this court now are, you just have to look at the briefs in the second appeal before the other panel, are the same arguments. The arguments that they made to the Supreme Court for cert are the same arguments.
Yeah, but the denial of cert is not an expression of an approval of a division of this court's decisions, is it?
It is not, but it does mean, from my point of view, that this, your decision in the second appeal is now the law of the case, and that is that the parents, the guardian's income is not to be taken into account, and these expenses, when the statute says they're divided by parents, it means just that they're divided by parents in proportion to the parents' income.
Are you aware of any Colorado cases where the law of the case has not controlled the subsequent division of this court in a case?
I'm not. That's not to say that there aren't, but I'm not personally aware of any where that's been the case, especially when the issues are so tied together. They both arise from the very same statute and the interpretation of that statute. The argument, this court found that there was no inconsistency between the probate code when it says that parents do not have a duty to pay expenses. Not parents, I mean guardians. The guardians do not use their personal resources. And the child support statute, which says that various expenses, parents have the duty for support, and various expenses are divided between parents in proportion to income. This court found no inconsistency, and that would be true in the current case. And so there's no need to harmonize these statutes. The other thing is that what the parents try to do is argue that another decision of this court in the Roderick case is somehow a conflict with this court's decision in Sidman. And that's because in Roderick, the court said that when you grant an APR, permanent parental responsibilities, to non-parents, and they subsequently get divorced, in that case it was granted because they were adopting the child. It was a prelude to adoption. That when you do that, and the parents get divorced, those parents who've taken on parental responsibilities have a responsibility to support the child. And I posit Roderick, it was distinguished by the court in the prior panel. But more than that, a guardianship is very different than an APR, or parental responsibility, decision of a district court in a family case. And I'm going to give you some of the main differences.
Well, before we go into that, Mr. Finkelstein, yes. At the present time, on the first case, that is the petition or the motion which was filed by the parents to end the guardianship.
Yes.
That cert was granted by the Supreme Court in that case. What if, and this is speculative, of course, what if the Supreme Court should reverse on that issue?
Well, if the oral argument on that case is set for September 3rd, should the Supreme Court reverse, my suspicion would be that they would be altering the standard by which you terminate guardianships, if they find in favor of the parents. And if they do that, it would be remanded to the district court for a new trial.
And what effect would that have on the second, the opinion which I drafted, authored, and the present case?
Your opinion was published by the court. I don't anticipate that it would have any effect on that opinion, even in this case, because as to the child support, transportation expenses, medical expenses, the decisions of this court will be binding. What might happen, I suppose, conceivably, is that at some point this child might go home to the parents if the parents were to prevail at a new trial, and then that would end. But in terms of what happens while the child is in the guardian's care, I believe this court's decisions would be controlling. with respect to that Roderick decision, the reason I raised the distinctions between APR and guardianships is because in that decision, they drew the distinction. They didn't elaborate on it, but guardians are not required to use their personal funds for the ward's benefit, whereas under Roderick, persons who are granted full parental responsibility are. That's by statute. The child remains a ward of the court. That's not true in APR cases. The guardians are subject to judicial supervision by statute. They have to account to the court periodically. In this case, it's once a year for the ward's benefit. They're authorized to apply for and receive money for the support of the ward. That's a statutory grant of authority, which is what they did in this case. They're authorized to commence legal proceedings to compel persons with a legal duty to support the ward. That's what they did, parents. And the guardianships should be modified in the ward's best interest under the statute. at least as of now, under the first decision, which I believe you wrote, Judge Carparelli, whereas in an APR, we've got the endangerment standard. So at least as of right now, there's quite a distinction between the court's decision in Roderick and the bases why that would have been rendered and the court's decision in Sidman and the bases that was rendered. If the court has questions, I'll address them. Otherwise, I'd reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Court, my name is Dan West. My bar number is 27573. I believe that counsel set forth the procedural history pretty good in this. It is fairly complicated, but in essence, a motion to terminate the guardianship was filed. That was denied by the trial court in Judge Caparelli's decision that was affirmed. Cert has been accepted on that case, and that remains pending. After the motion to terminate was denied by the trial court, the guardians brought a motion to establish child support. The court, in fact, did set child support, but include the guardian's income, and they set it under 14-10-115. The guardians appealed that. Justice Rivera overturned that and said that 14-10-115 wasn't applicable. Before that opinion was entered, this subsequent issue that's before you now was entered and basically saying that 14-10-115 applies to medical bills too, and so that the guardians could have a responsibility for those as well. I'm not going to argue that the issues are different in this case as they were in the first case. I think they're the exact same. So I have the thankless job of arguing to Justice Rivera that Justice Rivera was wrong.
But the Supreme Court has denied cert, and Judge Daley just mentioned that doesn't mean that the court agreed with that opinion. It just means that they're not going to do anything further about it.
I don't think you can read anything into it. In fact, it took them a long time to deny cert, and I don't know if that you can read anything into that either. So
no, you can.
And you would know that. <Yeah. laughs> But I respectfully submit that the Sidman case was decided wrongly, and I have 4 points on that. And the first one, as counsel argued, is the Roderick decision. Forget about the fact that the Roderick decision was an APR case, an allocation of parental responsibilities case. It's at the end of the day, Roderick says 14-10-115 applies to non-parents because they cite 14-10-115-1C for language that says this statute applies to any child support proceeding under any title. It doesn't say any title, but it lists some, but it's not a limiting. And that's what this is. In the Sidman case, there's a holding just the opposite, and it says 14-10-115 only applies to a parent. At the very least, those two decisions are conflicting with each other. More important, and I understand the distinctions that Roderick involved an APR case, but if you look very closely at Roderick, what Roderick decided was not because it was an APR case, but because they had what they defined as legal custody under the Children's Code, under 19-1-103. And Roderick goes through and says, look, these people are legal custodians under this the definition of the Children's Code, and therefore they have the obligation of support for the child. Likewise, in this case, and I argued this in the initial case, likewise, in this case, under the same statute, 19-1-103, guardians can be legal custodians. They can be legal custodians if nobody else has legal custody of the child, which is exactly what the case is here, or at least that's what I would assert. And so, Roderick...
Well, Mr. West, let me stop you right there and ask you where we're going to go with this. Let us assume for a moment that your argument is persuasive, and we would affirm the trial court on the medical expenses issue. How would we reconcile that with the issue? Was the case prior that we referred to?
I have no idea, Judge.
Thank you. Neither do I. That's my problem.
Okay. I had thought about it, but the truth is I can't come up with it. I think what you could do is overturn Sidman, the first Sidman case, and say that we were wrong when we decided the first Sidman case.
But is it proper for this division, which is a different division than the original Sidman case, proper for this division to say that the first division was wrong?
I believe so. I believe that you're the equivalent of them, and you can say we don't agree with it. Now, ultimately, maybe the Supreme Court decides that issue.
But, oh, I see. Okay.
But I don't believe that you're at the same level division is compelled to follow it. Now, obviously, there's a preference that you follow precedent, and I understand that. But that kind of goes to the law of the case question that I received. And I do have one example. I don't have the exact sites, but the RA, there's a case, line of cases. There's an RA1 and an RA2 that this court decided. It was ultimately, the RA2 case was ultimately overturned by CA. And it's not exactly that they didn't follow the law of the case, but an RA1 is an adoption. It was a grandparent visitation case. In RA1, this court essentially said, you have to give special preference to the wishes of a parent in granting grandparent visitation. But we're not going to define exactly what that is. The next case defined exactly what it was, which they said was only if there's harm or the parent is unfit could you order grandparent visitation. Ultimately, that was overturned in part by the Supreme Court. But that's a situation that I happen to know off the top of my head that didn't seem to follow the law of the case.
Mr. West, not because we're there's an old saying in the courts that it's not because we're omnipotent that we're right. It's we're right because we're last. But in the opinion which you referred to, which I drafted, it says, finally, unlike in the marriage of Roderick, in this case, no parental responsibility order was entered. In Roderick, the division specifically distinguished the parental responsibility order from guardianship by stating, quote, the parental responsibility order was not a guardianship order and did not create a ward-guardian relationship. Rather, the parental responsibility order was a prelude to adoption, and as such, it had legal significance established by statute. Now, clearly, there's a difference between it.
I understand that, but if you read Roderick, how I understand the Roderick decision is to simply say, when they talked about guardianships being different, they were rejecting the father's argument that I'm a guardian, and therefore I don't have a duty to support. They were simply saying, listen, you're not a guardian. You're getting APR, so it's dicta, for one thing. And I think if you look at it, and again, I made this point before, they didn't hold him to a duty of support in Roderick because he had APR, I don't believe. They held him to a duty of support because he was the legal custodian of the child under, as defined by the Children's Code. And again, under the Children's Code, guardians can also be legal custodians, and they should be in this case. So that's how I looked at that. I think we had that discussion before, and it wasn't persuasive then, but I'm going to try it again.
Thank you.
So let me talk about the language in the probate code. 1514-2092 is unambiguous. It says that a guardian need not use its own funds for the support of a ward. If that was the only statute in the probate code, that would be the end of the inquiry, but it's not. And as I pointed out in my brief, 1514-2071 says, except as otherwise limited by court, and I'm going to, guardians have the duty and the responsibility for a ward's support. And I've left out some of the words that are in there, but that's essentially what it says. So how do we reconcile those two statutes? Because they are not the same. They say two totally different things. And I think you have to look at rules of statutory construction to try and harmonize them. And what I suggested to you in my brief, the way to harmonize them is to look at 1514-207. It says, except as otherwise limited by the court. This is an unlimited guardianship. They didn't limit the responsibilities or the duties of the guardians in this case. Had they done that, they could have limited their duty to support the child. And one of the questions that I recall, and that's how I would say that you can harmonize those two conflicting provisions. One of the questions that Justice Rivera asked me at the last hearing was, well, don't we have to follow JCT? Absolutely, we have to follow JCT if it was applicable to this case, and I don't believe it is. And the reason I don't, if you look at JCT, which is a Colorado Supreme Court case, it says in dicta, again, that typically guardians don't have to pay support. First of all, I think that's factually incorrect. It's dicta, and it's not part of the ruling of the court. But at the same time, it's rare, and you may know from personal experience, but it's rare that I've seen guardians ask for support, at least in my practice. And I don't know if that comes up a lot here, but I just don't think that's factually correct. Finally, what I would argue is the equities in this case, and you asked about the current Supreme Court case, the first Sidman case that's currently pending, sir, or has been certain has been granted. If your two cases are if the ultimate solution is guardians don't have a duty of support and guardians are on an equal footing with parents, where's the equity here? What you have here is guardians asking to be treated as parents under every other circumstances other than the duty to support the child. And I don't think that's a fair result. I agree with counsel that the ultimate decision by the Supreme Court in the first Sidman case doesn't really affect the child support issue, but I do think you can look at the equitable issue involved there. I'll be honest with you, I've argued this case too many times. I don't have a whole lot of other things to say. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Counsel.
Very briefly, just in response, counsel argues to forget that Roderick was APR. I've given the court the reasons. There's major distinctions. Counsel has requested this court, in his words, forget that Roderick was an APR case. You can't do that. There's very different reasons why APR is in one statute, guardianships are in another.
Well, more importantly, Mr. Finkelstein, answer this question. Mr. West came up with an argument or a suggestion or a concern about dealing with this case in contravention to the prior case, which I authored. What's your view on that matter?
My view is that when different issues arise, significantly different issues arise, and you get different panels, you decide the issues based on the facts and law before you. In this case, the issue is the interpretation of a statute, the child support statute. And the child support statute is consistent with 1514-209-2. There's nothing inconsistent.
Well, what about this division overruling or changing or not following the prior division?
I believe, under the Dunkel decision and others, that you are required to follow your interpretation of that statute as you set out in this case, because it is an interpretation of law. The law of the case doctrine applies to interpretations of law made in the same case. So that's the view I have of that.
Hasn't this court said on many occasions we disagree with another division of the court?
We do, and that's typically, it does happen. And it happens when there are factual differences, different parties, different issues. You find distinctions in other cases. I've not seen it in the same case where on the second appeal, you say we disagree with what our brethren did on the first appeal because it's medical expenses versus transportation expenses, just by one example. You're still interpreting the same statute. The only reason they weren't together is that when I filed a motion to consolidate, it was opposed, it was denied, so we wind up here twice based on your decisions. But I posit that 1514-209-2 is unambiguous, as counsel suggested. It grants guardians immunity, meaning it's a privileges and immunities clause in the statute. That's what it's called. It's the immunity from having to use their own funds. It's consistent with the other provisions that guardians may apply for and receive money for the support of the ward. It's consistent with the other provisions that guardians may compel persons with a legal duty, meaning parents, to pay child support. And the argument that just because the child support statute says it'll apply in any title where child support is sought, so therefore it's being applied in Title 19, that doesn't mean that you apply it against the guardians. You apply it as written, as you stated in your first decision. It's written to provide parents to pay support. It's written to divide certain expenses, such as transportation expenses, medical expenses, in proportion to the parents' incomes. And quite frankly, that makes sense. In this case, the parents are together. Fine, they still have different incomes. But what if the parents were divorced? You'd still do it in proportion to the parents' incomes. You'd figure out how much the father's duty of support was, how much the mother's duty of support is. And that's precisely what we want going back to the district court, is the district court will look at the parents' respective incomes and determine what each parent's duty of support is, what their each parent's obligation is in proportion to income for transportation, medical expenses, and so on. Unless there's questions, I don't need to take more of the court's time. If you have a question, I'd be happy to answer it. Thank you.
Both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. Court will be in recess and the bailiff will so announce.
I just want to thank both counsel. It's very clear and straightforward arguments and appreciate that.